The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am Dr. Mike Karuchak, your guest host for today. I used to host this show all the time with Dr. Howe, but for the last 4 years, I just make occasional appearances, and today is one of those. So I'm delighted to be back in the Doctor's Lounge. I'm delighted and grateful for the opportunity to speak with you today. Before we introduce the subject of today's podcast, today's radio show, I want to ask you in advance, keep an open mind. Please keep an open mind, because when you hear what the subject is, many of you, if not all of you, are going to go, oh my gosh, please don't talk about that again. Don't talk about that person again. That person's been in and out of the news ever since COVID began, even before that. And I've heard all of the one political party say this person's a villain. I've heard all of the other political parties say this person is a hero. This person's been subjected to countless hours of hearings on Capitol Hill, and I'm tired of it. I don't need to hear the same thing over and over and over again. So I promise you up front that as we discussed Dr. Anthony Fauci today, you are going to hear things here that you have not heard before. I am not here to rehash the same old stuff and tell you that he's a hero or tell you he's a villain or tell you that he's somewhere in between with a little from column A and a little from column B. We're not going to do that. We're not going to say he's the arithmetic average between good and evil. We're actually going to go in a completely different direction. And there's a relevant and important reason for that. Now, why Fauci? Why do this now? Well, number one, he just came out with a book. Number two, he just was subjected to yet another set of hours of congressional hearings back on June the 3rd, right, this month. He was beat up on by both political parties again in the halls of Congress. And this is the first presidential election since the onset, or at least the denouement of the acute phase of the COVID pandemic. And all of these things, I think, make this a relevant subject, especially when hopefully I will succeed in taking your thoughts regarding Mr. Fauci and some of the larger issues that surround his experience in a direction that you have not heard before. And hopefully you find this worth your time. I promise I'm not going to waste your time talking about the same old things that have been talked about. I'm not going to, do an impression of my medical school classmate Rand Paul and write a whole book about how bad he is. I'm also not going to do an impression of his autobiography, which is, obviously very much the other direction for Dr. Fauci. So why are we analyzing one person? Why are people doing this? Why do people devote entire books to how great Fauci is or how bad Fauci is? And it's because I think his experience to date it is very illustrative, and I think it raises big questions for society in general. How do we regard experts? What do we do with experts? How do we treat experts? What are our expectations regarding experts? What are experts' expectations regarding themselves? What do experts think our expectations are regarding them? Do we trust experts anymore? If we do, why? Are experts allowed to not know an answer? Are experts allowed to be wrong? Are we, the people, allowed to disagree with experts? Is that okay? Or are we expected, especially if it's a government expert, are we expected to blindly follow those recommendations no matter what our own eyes and ears tell us? How much enforcement powers do we give experts? Do we let experts enforce their recommendations to the point where people who defy those recommendations lose their jobs, lose privileges, lose basic human rights, lose their ability to earn a living in the case of many physicians? Or does it need to be something less? What does that look like? Right? That's big question number one. Big question number two, what is the relationship, or at least what should it be? What really is it? What should it be? What's the relationship of government to experts? What does that look like? I mean, what if experts disagree with each other? What do we do there? What if government experts disagree with each other? What if there's two entities within governments that one says one thing and one says another, and you know, they want to put up a united front, but you know, that plan gets derailed at some point? What does that look like? What if the experts that government hires disagree with the politicians who hired them? Right? What are the political implications of an expert opinion? Will that expert opinion help one president get elected? Will it prevent that president from getting elected? What if the politician in question recognizes that and pressures the expert to offer a certain opinion, even if the expert feels otherwise? And what if the expert disagrees? Does that expert get fired? And if they do, what happens to them? I mean, if you're in a high-profile government job and you say something unacceptable to your bosses and they fire you, what career options do you have after that? How vulnerable are you? And finally, what does it look like for a physician in particular, right? We've been talking about just experts in general to this point, but what are the risks to a physician in particular? And this has personal implications to me and to all of my colleagues at the Doctor Patient Care Foundation and all of my policy colleagues at related organizations who are doing pretty much the same thing that we're doing, which is to say we're going to devote a significant amount of our time on healthcare policy. What does that look like? And, you know, what are the risks of success if you spend less time seeing patients and more time being a policy wonk, and maybe some of you get a lot of media exposure? What does that look like? What's the risk to a physician who leaves or at least diminishes their clinical practice and to go out and do something else? What if that fails? What happens to your practice that you walked away from? Right? Do physicians have the business acumen, the financial acumen, and the political skill to negotiate the hazards that exist once we choose to spend significant amounts of time outside the exam room, outside the hospital ward, outside the operating room, right? We were trained to function in those environments. We know those environments. In those environments, we are very, very smart people as a group. But what happens if we leave those places and our medical training is no longer directly useful, right? You know, knowing how to evaluate abdominal pain at 2 a.m., well, it's easy if that's what you're doing, but how useful is that to you when a politician pressures you to say something to help them that you know in your heart is not accurate based on your training and experience? How vulnerable are you? Right, we see this in other places, right? We talked a long time ago, and I'm talking a long time ago, like maybe over 10 years ago. We talked about the hazards when a doctor becomes a famous person doctor. And what happens if you become somebody's personal physician and you walk away from your patients and now your entire career is dependent on the whims and wishes of one person, right? Highly scary thing, right? When we live as docs in a regular clinical practice, we have, especially after 30 years like I have, you know, you have hundreds, maybe even thousands of patients out there, and each of those patients either wants to see you as a new patient or see you as a, you know, follow-up patient, as an existing patient. And, you know, that's a lot of inertia that's out there. That's a lot of demand that's out there. And you would have a very hard time making that demand go away completely. It's not going to hang on the whims and wishes of any one person. One person, well, maybe it's possible, or you could destroy somebody online, I suppose, but you still have a lot of, you know, you have a lot of momentum behind you after practicing long enough. But if you leave, if you leave clinical medicine, then eventually all those patients find other doctors to see. And all that work that you did to build your patient base and to build loyal patients who you've treated well, who go out and say, oh, you need an ENT, you need to go see Dr. K. I've been seeing Dr. K. He's a great guy, da 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 da. And that's what brings new patients through the door. That's what keeps the bills paid. That's what keeps bread on our table here at home. And then the question becomes, what happens when you give all that up? It's very seductive, just like it was very seductive years ago when we talked about if you want to be a doctor of famous people. I can tell you from personal experience, I had just enough of that that people really key on that. They want to know that you're so-and-so's doctor, even if you haven't seen that famous patient in 20 years. You're still so-and-so's doctor, and they just think that's really cool, even though you haven't really thought about them in your own head for a long time because they haven't seen you and they haven't needed care, and who knows, maybe they moved on and found another doctor. And lastly, what does the government think about experts? Like, what do they think about us deep down? Us being fellow physicians that work in government versus other kinds of experts. What happens when we're not useful to them anymore? We're going to look at a couple other famous people here as we get downstream in the other segments of the podcast and decide what happens when you're not useful to the government anymore, right? Fauci's gone through some of this, right? For decades through the AIDS epidemic, which, of course, we're still in. It's still a disease we're working on. But there was a point, for those of you who are old enough to remember, in the 80s and 90s, when AIDS, now we call it HIV more commonly, was a death sentence. If you had that positive lab, it wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. And in the beginning, once you got that positive test, you had about 2 years to live. And Dr. Fauci devoted his life to fixing that problem. And he was universally, I won't say that, we're going to go into those details, with some notable exceptions within the gay community, he was universally adored for taking this on. Now, decades later, he's universally adored by half of the people and by half of the government, and the other side hates him. So he's lost half his support despite all of his hard work. Is that his fault? Yeah, we're going to delve into that a little bit. But now he only has half the support he had before. What happens if the Democrats decide that he's not useful to them anymore? What if he does something that makes the Democratic politicians angry and they desert him too? What's left? You know, that may be one of the reasons he decided to retire at the end of 2022 from the NIH. It's probably a good time to make an exit and take a low profile and sort of cut his losses and not be quite so prominent. We'll talk about that stuff. We are at the end of segment one. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the americasbroadcastnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. Dr. Mike Korucak, your guest host for this week. Thanks for listening. Good to be with you again after so many months away from the microphone. To pick up where we left off, we are talking today about the career, the experience of Dr. Tony Fauci. And the reason we're doing this again is not to judge, not to pass judgment over whether he's a good guy or a bad guy or somewhere in between, a little from column A, a little from column B. This is part of a bigger analysis. This is an attempt to figure out what's the role of experts in our society. What is the nature of the three-way relationship between experts, the government, and the citizenry? And I don't think there's anybody in the last 50 years that has lived inside that socio-cultural triangle longer than Dr. Fauci. And so as we sort of look at his experience and look at his life to this point, it is with that thought in mind, and not to reiterate what so many other folks have done, to either judge him as a hero or judge him as a villain, or gush on and on in congressional hearings about how wonderful he is, or gush on and on in congressional hearings that he's not really a doctor and deserves to be in prison, et cetera, et cetera. You don't need me to do any of that. That's a waste of time. You want to hear that? It's out there already. Go find it. Listen to it. Make your own judgments if that's your desire. That's not what we're doing here. So before we go on, a confession from me, a disclosure, that researching this topic has been very difficult because you'd need hundreds of man hours of research to really understand some of these deeper issues. This is not my full-time job. I don't have that kind of time. So I beg your forgiveness in advance for any errors of omission or commission or facts that I'm missing that I should have. Again, anybody who's listening to this, you pick up something I missed, something I need to know, please share it. And I will be happy to accept that and modify my feelings and my position accordingly. Anyhow, let's talk about Fauci's lifetime, start at the beginning, and work through as quickly as we can without getting lost in too many places. He was born Christmas Eve, 1940. Very humble upbringing, similar to mine. I actually found review of his childhood and his early years and his education rather endearing. Grew up in a middle-class family, had some medical exposure because his family owned a pharmacy. He spent a lot of weekends and evenings and summer vacations delivering prescriptions on his bicycle. I did something similar. I delivered newspapers on my bicycle. He was, unlike me, he was a good athlete. He played baseball, which I love and I still play. He played basketball, which I had absolutely no talent for. And despite his short stature, actually made it to be captain of his very competitive high school basketball team. That's kind of gutsy to go out there at 5'7" and take on guys way bigger than you and be good enough to be your team captain, to earn that respect of your teammates. I think that's a big deal. He went to a small liberal arts undergraduate, Holy Cross, about the same size as the school I went to, went to Cornell Medical School. I applied there. I was accepted, chose not to go, but I went there. I was close. I liked the place and can stay there for residency. Moved on after residency, still in medical school. There is one other highlight I want to highlight, and this is actually a big one, which is that he lost his mom at the age of 24, his age of 24. It's a gripping story that he tells in his autobiographical book called On Call, where she came to visit him and she didn't feel very well. And he felt her belly and said, well, this is not good. Had one of his attending physicians examine her. The news wasn't good. And she was lost a couple of months later. I had a similar experience in med school. My dad tried to die during my medical school graduation. Came very close again. I had a parent cared for in the ICU of the institution in which I was trained. It is a unique experience, and so I find his experience with that very endearing. We both had an interest in immunology in medical school and did special studies in that regard. And so as I'm listening, I'm reading this, you know, I find it very endearing and I kind of like him. So let's move on. So interesting sequence of training here because, I don't know that this happens anymore, but after his residency, but before his chief year, he went to NIH. And was a research fellow for 3 years at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and then went back to Cornell for his chief year, and then went back to NIH after that. And now we're talking about 1972. And so he served in the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease from 1982 to 1984, and in 1984 was made the head of NIAID. And served there for 38 years until 2022. So reviewing his training and his younger years, there's only one observation I made that was a little bit critical or at least a little bit analytical, which is that Dr. Fauci never took care of patients in the wild, so to speak. What do I mean by that? He was always in academic medicine, or he was always at the NIH, which is a variant of academic medicine. He was never in private practice and never took call to take care of patients completely on his own. And you may regard that as trivial. To me, it's not some kind of deal breaker as to whether I like him or not. Certainly not. But it is a piece of the patient care experience that appears to be, based on what I'm reading, appears to be missing. And there is, and he would say, no, I took plenty of call in residency. We took plenty of call. Med students take plenty of call. I'm talking about when you're on your own, there's no attending physician to fall back on. You know, you get that phone call from the ER at 2 a.m. or from the ICU at 2 a.m. with a dastardly problem that requires your attention immediately. You are it. And so it's a little interesting. I have a teeny bit of an issue with him calling his autobiographical book On Call, because there's a big piece of On Call that it appears, as near as I can tell, that he didn't do. That's okay. Not a big deal, but it is something that I felt like I wanted to bring up, is again, there's nothing like being on call when, you know, whoever comes through the ER that they call you, man, it's yours to take care of. You know, in my specialty of ENT, you got an airway problem, you got a neck abscess, you got a nosebleed, you're it. Cause, and if you ain't fixing it, ain't nobody fixing it. And that's a feeling until that happens for a few years in your early years and you get that sinking feeling in your gut. Maybe he had a place he felt that. I can't find it from the research again. Maybe I'm missing something. But in terms of his early years, that's kind of my reflections. 99% of everything that's there I like, I have one small point of issue. That's about it. So then let's move on to his first major challenge in the NIAID, which is HIV, right? And that's really the defining disease of his career, right? In recent times, we know about him because of COVID, because that was such a high profile and such a time compressed disease relative to HIV. That's what we all remember over the last 4 or 5 years. But really, he spent decades on HIV. And I was impressed with how he handled that situation for one very particular reason, not because of, you know, his medical acumen or his research acumen, but because of his political acumen or his financial acumen, because that's not something that you get in medical training. We both, by self-selection and by training, we know how to take care of sick people, but intrinsically we don't know how to do much else. And yet, when Dr. Fauci was out there as kind of the high profile guy dealing with HIV and trying to come up with meds that were effective and at least prolonged life, because remember, this was a 1 to 2 year death sentence from diagnosis in the 80s, that in spite of that, in spite of being sort of a tireless worker for this, he got pushback because something new happened during his early tenure, which was that the population of patients, the gay population, organized itself as a political group, and that had never happened with patients before. Patients just went to doctors and accepted what they were told and accepted what they were given. This was the first time that a group of patients affected by a disease went, hey, wait a minute, we don't like what you're doing here. We don't think you're doing enough. We don't like the job that you're doing. And, you know, there were certain activists within the gay community that called Dr. Fauci an incompetent idiot. Now that has to blow your mind as doc. That's certainly, you know, we have patients who criticize us. I've certainly had patients that criticize me, but it's one thing to go in the public forum as a political activist at a protest and publicly demonstrate against you. And how must that feel when you're devoting your life to this disease and the people you're trying to save appear to hate you? How does that work? How can my patients hate me so much as to do this to me? And his dealing of HIV gives an excellent account of how he handled that, which I thought was great. Instead of, you know, he could have hunkered down in the NIH. He could have just said, I'm staying here. I'm not dealing with these people. But instead he went out and he met them. He went out and met the people who hated him, who called him idiots, and said, what can I do for you? Now that's gutsy. You know, and it implies that, you know, his heart and mind were in the right place. And this is not just in his autobiography. This comes from, you know, I had a couple of three sources that all sort of corroborated this. And so this is good. I mean, because the community had some legitimate concerns, some legitimate objections. And when he went out and faced the community, you know, in the trenches, so to speak, he learned a great deal. Found out that, you know what, you know, just a bunch of scientists doing research in an ivory tower and handing out whatever they came up with, that they needed to communicate with patients and find out what their needs were. This is where the first sort of the precursor of right to try came from, is that, you know, these protocols were so tightly regulated and people were dying by the thousands, going blind from CMV, cytomegalovirus. And they finally said, look, we need to do better here. We need to make these drugs available outside of protocol for people that are dying so quickly that we need to do this. So this was a great thing that he did. And, you know, pissed off a lot of the government people that he worked with in the process, but did it anyway. And finally, the people who called him an incompetent idiot turned around and called him a hero. That's pretty solid political work. We're at the end of the segment. You're listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Hey folks, this is Victor with the On Point with Victor show. Make sure you listen every Tuesday, 1 to 2, only right here on America's Web Radio, the On Point with Victor show. Remember folks, I'm not angry, I'm just right. And you can find out why every Tuesday from 1 to 2, the On Point with Victor show, only right here on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. I am Dr. Mike Karuchak, your host for today's show, guest host. Hopefully you enjoy the break. I hope Hal and Scott enjoy the break, where neither one of them has to do a show this week. It's summertime. I presume that they're enjoying vacations, which is great. Gives me a chance to come in and spend a little time with you, which I very much enjoy, and I am very much grateful for the two of them to offer me the opportunity. We are talking about Dr. Fauci's life. And we're doing it with the goal of looking at the broader role of experts relative to government and relative to the citizenry. And after we get Dr. Fauci's career summarized or reviewed and kind of analyzed a little bit, the goal is, again, to look at some of these bigger questions regarding the role of experts in society and relative to government, the role of doctors when they step out of their clinical role and move into roles that do more with healthcare policy like we do, so obviously near and dear to our hearts at the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. And what are the hazards? What risks do doctors take when they do that, when they step away from the exam room, the hospital ward, the operating room, and do these sorts of things? It's a relevant question to us. And even if you're not a doctor, it's a relevant question because certainly COVID changed our perception of experts and how experts are supposed to behave and how we regard them. What are our expectations of experts? So we were summarizing at the end of segment two, and I ran a little short on time, what I thought was a great job that Dr. Fauci did of learning about the politics of disease when the gay community organized and became an activist community relative to AIDS, to what we call HIV now, and made demands on the NIH and the research community to say, look, you know, if you're just going to sit in your labs and sort of conjure up treatments on a leisurely basis, that's just not good enough. We got people dying by the droves out here, and even the life-saving drugs you give, you know, the way the research protocols are designed, we're having horrible morbidity, you know, because, you know, we're taking AZT to live longer, but we're not taking the drug to stop cytomegalovirus from making us blind. You know, there needs to be a better way. And he came up with the idea of, I think it was called parallel tracks, which is sort of a precursor of right to try. And we said, look, we're going to do the research protocols the way we always do them. But parallel to that, we're going to make these drugs available in a way that, you know, we call right to try right now, which means that if a patient is in dire straits, their disease is rapidly taking their life or destroying their life, that we give them the ability to try drugs that have not yet been proven safe and effective conclusively by the FDA. Because, to put it bluntly, you got nothing to lose. Without the treatment, the disease is ravaging you and you're going to die. Let's give these patients the right to try if they so desire. And this turned a lot of people who declared themselves as enemies of Fauci and the gay community to becoming allies. And for folks that said, yep, you know what? You came out here in the trenches, you talked to us, you listened, you made changes, we're benefiting. Thank you. That's great. Because I guarantee you, nobody in medical school or residency or fellowship taught him how to do that. He figured that out, presumably from the research I've done, from his own insights, that he sort of generated that idea out of his devotion. Many people advised him against it. People said, don't go out there, don't do this. Right, stay sequestered in the halls of the NIH because you're taking a huge risk going out there. He did it anyway. That's great. Gutsy. Successful. Now let's move into COVID and get down to the nitty-gritty and some of the things that happened and some of the reasons why once again, Fauci came under fire from politicians, from the citizenry, despite his exalted status as really America's doctor, as it came to happen during COVID. He was always up there next to presidents talking about it, two presidents, Trump and Biden. And in spite of that position that you would think would sort of make him everybody's friend, in fact, that was not the case, not even close. So what was it that caused all of the controversy? Well, in my opinion, it came down to three things. It came down to policy on masks, policy on vaccines, and this whole question of the NIH funding the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And was the NIH involved in funding the so-called gain-of-function research And was there almost the ultimate irony that the NIH was involved in, or the allegation that the NIH was involved in funding the creation of the very virus, COVID, that they're now devoted to fixing with a vaccine and with medicines and controlling this outbreak, that they created the very problem they've devoted themselves to fixing. Those were the allegations. I think those were the 3 points. So let's talk about those. So in terms of masks, there was, you know, phases that we went through with mask recommendations. And maybe you remember some of this, maybe you don't, but the initial position, again, offered by Dr. Fauci himself in this particular instance, was that the public did not need to be wearing masks immediately. And the thought process was, we had not ramped up a mask supply, right? COVID caught us and the rest of the world completely off guard. And so we didn't have enough masks. And ironically, who was making all the masks for us? China. And so we didn't have enough to give a huge supply of masks to every man, woman, and child in America. So what do you do? Well, healthcare workers were taking huge risks and taking care of their patients. So the idea was, and as a healthcare worker, I support this, which is to give masks to healthcare workers because we know they're going to come in contact with infected people. At this early stage in the pandemic, there was going to be less exposure in public than healthcare workers were going to get. And that was at least an interim policy until we could somehow figure out how to get enough masks for everyone. And the other part of the mask thing, in my opinion, is that it's interesting how caught off guard we were about masks. As it turns out, the mask situation is a very complicated situation. And this surprised me to death, right? As a surgeon and a doctor, I've been wearing masks for hours and hours and hours in the operating room and in, you know, if there's infectious precautions for a patient on the ward way before COVID. So I can wear a mask without thinking. I used to forget I had it on and go places you didn't need one, like outdoors or be outdoors. People go, why are you wearing a mask? You're like, oh, I forgot I had it on. But it's interesting how little science we understood about masks and how little we understood the differences between the conventional surgical masks, sort of the paper cotton mask or a paper mask versus a cloth mask versus an N95 mask versus those masks that are even more intense than N95 masks and, you know, charcoal filter things that you wear on your face like a gas mask. And nobody understood what was good and what wasn't. And the public didn't understand what was good and what wasn't. How many times did we see people walking around with masks and their nose sticking out above the mask? Well, it seems obvious to me as the doc, and maybe it's not so obvious to lay folks, that, you know, if you wear a mask and your nose is sticking out of it, that you might as well not wear the masks. And there was a point where the World Health Organization and the CDC were advocating the use of a non-medical, non-surgical cloth mask. So we had a lot of things working against us. One is we needed an interim policy so that healthcare workers could have access to the limited mask supply. We were caught off guard regarding the basic science of mask types, mask use, mask technique. And so that really left us with a problem. So the other piece is that we did not recognize that masks have more than just a medical implication, right? There's a symbolism with masks. And a lot of people took the mask as, you know, a symbol of government oppression, right? We're going to cover up your mouth so you can't express yourself, even though obviously you can. We're going to cover up your face and suppress your identity. And a lot of people keyed on that and said, well, we're not wearing masks. And again, armed with the fact that there was a lack of evidence, you know, that was a problem. You know, what else was a problem? Well, we had a problem with vaccines. And you know, again, how can vaccines be political? Well, they certainly can be political, as we discovered that, you know, when a Republican president, starts Operation Warp Speed and the vaccine gets developed in record time, we have Republicans supporting it and Democrats going, whoa, 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 hey, wait, this is getting developed too quickly. This sounds dangerous to us. And then when Trump lost in November 2020 and Biden takes over, all of a sudden, vaccines are perfect. Right now we mandate vaccines. The other problem is that and Fauci talks about this in the book, and I have an issue with his argument. And he's made this argument in multiple venues. I understand the argument, but I think it's incomplete at best. And the argument is, well, hey guys, you keep changing your tune, right? First we didn't need masks, then we did need masks, then cloth masks were okay, then they weren't okay, then medical masks were okay, then you needed an N95 mask. Why the inconsistency? And Fauci's answer is, well, of course there's inconsistency. That's the very nature of science. That as we learn things and we acquire experience, we change our position, right? You know, 1,000 years ago, the earth was flat. Now it's round. Why? Because we got smarter in several hundred years. Same thing happens on a compressed time scale with something like masks. Well, if that's the case, why were we so arrogant when we understood that we were probably ignorant about masks and about the vaccine and about all those things? Why did we require people to wear masks? Why did we throw people out of businesses if they refused to wear a mask? Why did we do these things? We'll get back to the rest of this. We're at the end of segment three. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, join me, Roger B., every Tuesday at 1400 hours right here on America's Web Radio for the Locked and Loaded show. We will talk about guns, weapons, ammo, gun accessories, prepping, and so much more. So be sure to join us every Tuesday at 1400 or 2 p.m. for Locked and Loaded on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the americasbroadcastnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. I am Dr. Mike Karuchak, your guest host for this week. Segment four, the home stretch. We'll see if we can wrap this up. We were at the break trying to do a limited dissection of some of the major issues surrounding COVID and how they led to so much controversy surrounding Dr. Fauci. You would think intuitively the position he was in as sort of America's doctor, the sort of the fearless, peerless leader, the expert that we were all looking to for guidance as a terrifying disease ravaged our country and, of course, the whole world. And yet how, in a situation like that, can you end up in a situation where, you know, there is a significant number of people who don't like you very much? And we were dissecting three major issues, and actually there's four if you count social distancing. So what were the controversial issues? Well, social distancing was one. Masks, we had talked about in the last segment, was another one. Vaccines, and then one that was sort of a more of a historical event, which is what was up with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Did our country fund a Chinese lab, which ultimately created potentially the very virus that we were devoting ourselves to fighting? And then sort of overshadowing all of those issues is this inconsistency coming from lots of people, but including Dr. Fauci, not limited to Dr. Fauci, but this inconsistency regarding the nature of science. And since we haven't talked about vaccines yet, let's talk about vaccines. Remember, they got started on this very quickly in 2020. They had Operation Warp Speed. They put a huge amount of money into it. They engaged the private sector. The government assumed the financial risk of whether or not the vaccine would be effective, and sort of took that risk off of private industry so that they were free to spend a whole bunch of money to get this vaccine on board. And of course they were successful. And in late 2020, again, I remember as a healthcare worker in January of 2021, I was very happy and grateful and relieved to get that vaccine, because we as healthcare workers were living in terror is probably an overstatement, but we were very concerned. And ear, nose, and throat doctors like myself were extremely concerned, because we got, you know, for us to take care of you as an ENT patient, we got to get our face next to your face. We look in your nose. We look in your mouth. We're all over you where that virus is being shed. And so I was very grateful to get that vaccine series of two in January of 2021. But we all know that there's a lot of controversy around those vaccines. Once folks got comfortable that they were effective, and again, that's the question. It was a false sense of security, it turns out, that vaccines were made to be mandatory. Employers required them. Healthcare entities required them. The military required them. And if you had a concern about this vaccine because it was so quickly developed, we don't know the side effects. Maybe it's not as safe as we think. Maybe it's not as effective as we think. Those folks were reviled. They were excluded. They were fired. If you were in the military, you were relieved of duty and probably discharged, probably not honorably discharged. And so we had a lot of social, political, financial pressure to accept the vaccine, whether you were comfortable with it or not, right? They talked about the pandemic of the unvaccinated, right? And how terrible these people were. They were putting the entire society at risk. And it turns out that none of that's true. In the end, the vaccine reduces the severity and duration of disease. It does nothing to reduce your odds of contracting the disease. It makes you're still just as capable of transmitting the disease. So this idea that folks who were reluctant to take the vaccine and refused the vaccine were putting the rest of us in danger turns out not to be true. Now, what would Fauci say about this? Well, that's okay, right? That's the nature of science. We learn quickly in the case of a COVID thing where there's so much pressure to learn as fast as we can, and we update our recommendations as we acquire knowledge. Well, if that's the case, sir, why is it that when we know we're going to be smarter 6 months from now than we are now, why did we make the vaccines mandatory? Why did we ruin careers? Why did we ruin lives over convictions that turned out to be untrue in the end? And that's the problem I have. It's one of the big problems I have with how this was handled. Now, what I don't know is how much was Dr. Fauci directly involved. I don't have enough time to research that. For instance, the whole social distancing thing, the 6-foot thing, that came from the CDC. Fauci had nothing to do with that. I got multiple sources that confirmed that. So how much of this, and Fauci, he says it in the book, and I believe him, that he didn't have nearly the control. He didn't have any control over the FDA. He didn't have any control over who made vaccines mandatory and who didn't, at least not directly, not officially. but I have an issue with how that was handled. And, you know, I have this, I have a problem with Dr. Fauci's attitude. You know, it was a terrible look. It was terrible optics when he said people oppose me because I represent science and they don't like science. So they don't like me because I'm the good guy and they're the bad guy. And I have a problem with that. I, you know, wrapping yourself in the mantle of science and saying that you are a representative of science is very distasteful to most of us in medicine because that's not our attitude towards science. It's not the appropriate attitude towards science, in my opinion. We are students of science. We are devotees of science. We are not masters of science. We are not – science doesn't serve us. It's the other way around. And, you know, it's terrible optics the way he put that. Maybe if he had a do-over, he'd take it back. I don't know. His autobiography, as near as I can tell, I read most of it, skimmed some of it. He did not tackle that issue anywhere as far as I know, and I'm happy to be corrected on that. But the idea that I represent science, whether I say that or he says that or anybody says that, I think is a bit presumptuous. It's definitely a bit pompous, and it doesn't help the situation, especially when you admit the nature of science is that knowledge changes, recommendations change, and yet we were so enamored with our early recommendations, we were willing to ruin lives over it. I don't like that look. Let's move on. You know, there is now, I still want time here. Let's see, we're 8 minutes in and we got 5 minutes left. I want to talk about the hazards that Dr. Fauci faced, the hazards that any of us face when we decide to step out of a medical career, a traditional career of patient care in the exam room, the wards, the operating room, and decide to endeavor to influence healthcare policy, in the example of us, you know, Fauci's example, to be, you know, America's doctor standing next to presidents making recommendations. What risks do we take doing that? And the bigger question even than that is, what is our societal cultural expectations regarding experts? What's the three-way relationship between experts, the government, and the citizenry, all complicated by the press, who likes to start a fight? And there are some interesting insights that Fauci offers with his experience in the Trump White House mainly, not exclusively, because remember, he served under Biden as well, obviously. But you read the accounts of all the different players inside the White House, and there are a great deal of them. This is not just a story of Trump. There's lots of other names and lots of other faces and a lot of, you know, palace intrigue, so to speak, that makes me wonder, and it's not just this part in the book, but it's even our own personal experience going to Capitol Hill, you know, board members of the Doctor Patient Care Foundation, us, we've been to the White House on multiple occasions. We've experienced some of this personally. And all of this together leads me to ask the question, what does the government behind closed doors, what do they really think of us? Do they respect us at all? Or are we just useful idiots to them? Why do I say such a thing? Why do I raise such a question? Well, reading Fauci's accounts of his interactions with all of these folks in the White House, I get the sense that they were trying to manipulate Fauci. They were manipulating him. They would publicly criticize and privately say, hey, you know what? We're good. We love you. You know, we had to do what we had to do. But that just seems so inconsistent. I wonder, do they think that they can just manipulate us? Are we useful to them, or are we just, or are we, do they respect us, or are we just useful idiots to them. I don't know. I know enough to ask the question. I'm not smart enough to suggest an answer, but it concerns me. It concerns me personally because, you know, we endeavor to go to the Capitol Hill, to go to the White House, and we would like to continue to advise if the opportunity ever arises. But it's a question that's on my mind. What are the expectations of experts? Are experts allowed to be wrong? What if experts disagree? What if politicians pressure experts to say certain things at certain times? There was a lot of pressure from the White House in 2020 to somehow wrap up the COVID epidemic by Easter. They saw Easter as a big landmark on the calendar, and they really wanted to wrap up, so to speak, the COVID epidemic and be done with it by Easter. Right? Fauci's response is the virus doesn't care when Easter is. How do you expect to wrap this up by Easter? This is not a meeting. This is not a project. We're fighting a force of nature here. We're fighting a hostile force of nature here. How do you expect us to manipulate this in a way that changes the rules of nature when we don't even know what the rules of nature are with respect to this virus because it's brand freaking new? How do you do that? Well, there is no way to do that. So what do you do as an expert when you're pressured by your bosses to say certain things at certain times, realizing that if they fire you, you might not have a career to go back to, right? You gave up your patience to go serve the public. Now you're out of a job. Don't know. We're at the end of the hour. Thank you for listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.